15. We're moving to item 16. We're a little behind of an hour. Hatchery Policy C-3619. This is a briefing and public hearing only. Mr. Warren, thank you for your patience. You look lovely today.
Oh, goodness. Can you guys see that?
Yes, sir.
Dan.
Fantastic. Hopefully I can, the buttons work for me. So I'll get going. Chair Carpenter, Commissioners, Director, Deputy Director Ron Warren in the Director's office, here today to provide a briefing, and you'll have a public hearing on draft language of the anadromous salmon and steelhead hatchery policy. I hope to cover the key provisions of the policy and the follow-up schedule that we will go through. The policy starts off with, and of course, I don't have a way to see my notes that I have in the PowerPoint presentation, so I'll just do it off what's there. Apologies for that. Policy starts off with a purpose. Primary purpose is to advance conservation and recovery of wild salmon and steelhead, to perpetuate salmon and steelhead in accordance with existing mitigation programs and agreements for permanently lost habitats, to provide sustainable economic and stability benefits to recreational, commercial, and tribal fisheries in Washington. For those who were at the Fish Committee meeting the other day, I realized that as I was going through the presentation, I'd forgotten a section. So let me pick that up here. The authority, definition, and intent of the policy section, again, to the intent of the policy is to provide direction, goals, objectives, and actions to improve hatchery efficiencies and ensure capabilities between hatchery salmon and steelhead production and wild populations, and how that is done in a conservation fashion. So from there, we get into some of the general provisions. Common theme, the highest priority of the policy commitment shall be to the conservation of natural resources. I know all of you have had this for a little bit, and most of you were at the Fish Committee meeting. Hope not to abbreviate this too much. I know you've had a long weekend so far, but I think that this is important to go through. So, so to continue in that, the maintenance of wild populations currently in healthy conditions. Sorry, I jumped way ahead. So the policy commitment for shall high priority policy commitment shall be for the conservation of natural resources, then including the conservation and recovery of depressed populations, and then to the maintenance of those populations that are currently in healthy status. Conservation of genetic resources found in hatchery populations and providing critical ecological benefits to those other listed species, such as southern resident killer whales. So additional general provisions to maintain a strong co-manager working relationship, to give full consideration of scientific and policy perspectives, to have a cooperative approach to decision making on salmon and steelhead and the hatchery programs, matters that directly affect treaty reserved fishing rights. The policy also directs the department that upon completion that we would initiate a joint policy with our tribal co-managers on salmon and steelhead so that we have a common understanding of how all of us would operate those facilities. And we have some examples to follow our joint co-manager disease policy that we've briefed the commission on in the past is the example that we're asked to try to follow. So then the commission goes on to policy guidelines, and these policy guidelines are very similar to the past guidelines. First talks about that there can be genetic risks by operating hatchery programs on salmon and steelhead, and that there can also be significant risks in from an ecological perspective. And both of these guidelines ask us to commit to rigorous HGMP hatchery and genetic management plan development, not only on those facilities and programs within the Endangered Species Act areas, but also those that are outside of that area. And we'll get to some more of that later on. So then policy guideline number three, just to recognize the benefits of well-managed hatchery programs, that the HGMP provisions should reflect a balance between the need to minimize the genetic and ecological risks to those natural populations and providing for ecological and societal benefits of the hatchery and the programs that they release into the state waters. Four goes into a bit more detail relative to the hatchery and genetic management plans. Again, those first, at least three of the first four that I'm covering here were very similar to the previous policy. Much of this policy is possible or slight language changes, but very similar in nature. That hatchery management plans shall be developed for every anadromous salmon and steelhead hatchery program operated under the authority of this policy. And I think that what's really important there is that we are, and as you see the prototype table of contents later, I think you'll get a particular sense of how that provides documentation of our operations that should result in an ability to be accountable to you and this policy in how we report that because of the annual plans that you'll see in a moment as well. So very important that we continue to be stringent about what we know about the interactions of hatchery and wild populations and document those risks and benefits in the HGMPs. Policy also guides us to continue our external marking and has some exceptions to that if state tribal agreements speak to not doing it, conservation, other management purposes, or to fulfill research needs. And again, this slide, for those who may have received it early, the initial part of the very first sentence was a duplicate from a previous slide. My apologies for that. We've got that corrected and changed on the website as well. But this is a guideline that just assuring that the agency is striving to secure the necessary funds to ensure the department operations of hatchery facilities, and that in doing so, we're striving to meet those environmental regulations for hatchery operations. This gives some examples, and to follow the adaptive management provisions that are within the policy as well. So policy guideline number 7, considering the questions of balance between risk and possible impacts on wild populations, hatchery programs conducted in accordance with the policy. Again, the highest level of protection from possible negative effects of hatchery programs on those wild populations shall be provided. And that those wild populations that have not had substantial genetic modifications from past hatchery practices or those that are healthy now be documented and assure that we continue to operate properly, not to increase those risks or to further harm those populations. Guideline number 8 is that how we will currently or in the future continue to implement different strategies to expand the methods of how we separate hatchery and wild species, whether that's through weirs or other new design features that we could put in to our facilities through our capital enhancements that we have ongoing, to keep them separate on the spawning grounds to the best of our ability and to for those parameters that are so detailed in literature. From there, we go into the adaptive management, and the adaptive management section calls for procedures that are essential to achieve the purposes of the policy. It also calls out the annual reports that I spoke to previously, and if that we are not achieving those parameters within the policy, to document efforts to determine why and actions that we would take to correct the course, expectations to implement actions and manage them adaptively, and then any new information that arises to communicate that with the commission, as well as have a coordinated effort with co-managers to address those, as well as a transparent public process to assure that our constituents and around the state know what's going on within our hatchery infrastructure. Continuing with the adaptive management, within the first year, provide a written proposal for overarching regional or statewide evaluation or research that is more extensive than described in the HGMPs. The department shall seek funding. Again, that's a common theme that we have fully funded facilities operating properly, and that we can continue to monitor those in a way that gives us confidence that we are doing everything we can for the recovery and of species that they coexist with. And then think to wrap up adaptive management, the department also is requested to, or the commission's requiring the department to provide qualitative and comprehensive review of the policy performance in different timeframes in 2024 and in 2030 for different review processes. Again, good accountability provisions that keep the department on track with achieving continued hatchery reform measures. So I'm going to try to break off from my shared screen just for a moment, because I have other sharing to do relative to the appendix, the table of contents for the Hatcher Genetic Management Plan, and then a schedule for those plans and where we are. So I'll just hopefully start with the prototype for the Hatchering Genetic Management Plan, just a table of contents. And you can see from as I will scroll down through this, that the Hatchery Genetic Management Plans are a very thorough document required for the operation and review the documents in areas where we have listed species are utilized by NOAA Fisheries for the review and approval of operations or take provisions under the Endangered Species Act. They go into a great deal of detail, as they should, and they, from funding sources to the purpose or the goal of the program, the justification of the program, performance standards, risks and benefits, survival rates, a bunch of different parameters that are in the general provisions. It moves on to cover the program effects on other ESA-listed species, just as we saw in those initial guidelines to the department. Be mindful of those, and we'll document in these HGMPs how that interaction and what we're doing to curtail the negative effects, how the relationship of the program with other management objectives. So there may be management plans with other listed species. So the example here is the Hood Canal Summer Chum Conservation Initiative. There may be other plans, MOUs, MOAs, that we have to be mindful of in how we are operating facilities that we're going to inform NOAA about that may have some constraints in what we do. Goes into the water sources that we use, the physical layout of the facilities, what the brood stock collection will look like, and any fish transport equipment, how that's going to be used, the holding of those adults as they return, different incubation and rearing facilities or acclimation and release sites that may be used. It also goes into the brood stock from an origin and identity perspective and what the sources are going to be, and indicating any of the risks that may be taken from those genetic or ecological effects on those listed fish that recur occur from the result of the brood stock selection practice. Gets into life history and the collection. So what our program is, gets into the mating and how we're going to fertilize at what rates and how we're going to cross-fertilize in a matrix that has been used and approved, release strategies and how we're going to do that to make sure that we minimize the negative effects on natural populations, that they've had an ability to out-migrate properly. If we're transporting fish and how we're going to do that or acclimate in other areas in the applied time frames. You can see that it a pretty extensive list of different operational from all of the details from broodstock management to eggs to rearing, and then all of the fish health constraints that we put ourselves under, also done in a co-manager format through the co-manager disease policy. It also gets into research and what we need to do, what we are doing, and gets us to the how we are showing what those risk aversion measures are and how they're being applied.
Ron, if I may, Commissioner Thorburn has a question or comment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. Wow, I had no idea how complex the HGMPs are, and take comfort in knowing how closely we're looking at these hatcheries and the work of the hatcheries. I have a question. In the first section, you actually mentioned that how NOAA uses these and said that they use them for determining take allowances. And that was a little confusing to me because I kind of think of take more in fisheries management. We're talking hatchery management here. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on how the HGMP relates to decisions about take.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Thorburn, thank you for the question. What I was trying to indicate is that in many cases, our hatchery fish are the listed species as well as those spawning naturally, and that we have to have take authorization to lethally spawn, transport. There's some pre-spawn mortalities. All of those operational considerations that take fish or as we are raising those fish, the mortalities that occur, that's why they're verifying incubation, rearing, mortalities, any of the marking programs for further evaluation, any research work that we're doing, they are evaluating that to assure that the mortality rates or the ESA take is not exceptionally high and that it's within the standard and that we're meeting those objectives under their biological opinions as they write them.
Thanks a lot for the clarification. That's very helpful.
You bet. So again, I'm going to stop and then reshare. So here is the status of the, and this is what would be Appendix 2. This is not complete yet, but I wanted to be able to share it to show that in what we are doing, we currently have 120 HGMPs that are either complete or in some kind of process. I'll scroll down just to be able to show the different regions of the state, the different hatchery programs, and where we are complete. As we get down, you'll notice that some are in consultation, and then there's a larger section, our coastal facilities that are in non-ESA listed areas. These are the ones that we're still talking about relative to the ongoing work of those HGMPs that are in the queue for co-manager approval, submittal to NOAA, the NOAA review and the approval through their opinions for us, but then how we would go about developing those HGMPs so that we had fully vetted and documented, well-documented operational standards at those non-ESA listed facilities. So in total, when we would be done, we would have 165 programs that are for salmon and steelhead that would have operational HGMPs that would be able to be viewed by the public and or the commission and that we would report on a regular basis. And sorry for jumping around so much here, but So I've completed the very quick review of the two appendix documents. And so then to we're here on within the schedule. I truncated this for ease. Certainly there's been a 2-year process of review for this policy. All of that from my perspective, I left out of the schedule just to be able to say all of the information that the commission needed to be able to make an informed decision on the policy, their original draft of the policy, and then how it would move forward and how it could come to a possible consideration of final adoption is between this meeting, a September meeting where we would, if approved, to submit or get a draft out for public comment, we would come back, inform the commission about what kind of public comment we received, any modifications that the agency might see in that we thought we needed to add, and then present that in September. And then in your October meeting, you would consider final adoption. So, Chair Carpenter, that concludes my presentation.
Okay. Anybody have any questions now, or do you want to come back after public comment? I'm asking the commissioners.
Okay. I have a quick question.
Dave, go ahead.
Ron, I know that the approval of HEMPs was way behind schedule with NOAA for a period. We asked for a better servicing from the agency. I believe even our agency provided some staff to assist them, and they tried to accelerate the process to get our HGMPs in place. What's the current status?
I can provide, we have a separate spreadsheet that would show you those current status. We still think that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is still struggling to meet NOAA fisheries is the main biological opinion authorship, but through consultation for all of our programs, U.S. Fish and Wildlife continues to struggle with the demand for review and work through those consultations. We continue to work with them. That's where we had the previous staff that were dedicated to help their work. We had to pull that staff person back because of needs within our hatchery and evaluation and assessment team, our HEAT unit, to further develop and coordinate responses for HGMPs. Much better. You could see on a cursory review, and those two appendix documents are also available on under the commission agenda item. Here you could go on and look at how many are now complete and or under consultation with the federal agencies, as well as those that are still under co-manager development. And then certainly the list of 45 new HGMPs that would be required by the policy for the future. But are we still behind? Yes. Are we making a better, are we tracking better than we had been? Absolutely. NOAA is doing a much better job, and we have quarterly meetings between us and the co-managers and NOAA to review any issues, talk through those issues, schedule those local meetings amongst co-managers so that we have finalized HGMPs that can be submitted to NOAA as promptly as possible, and then get updates on those that are under consultation and where they are and when they're thinking they're going to be complete.
Ron, could you go back to policy 5? I've read this umpteen times, and I have a question or two about that. Get clarification on.
So policy guidance number 5, this one?
Yeah, let's see. You know, I'm just a little bit concerned in advance of what public scrutiny we might get based on a publicly funded program here. And this is not directed in any way, shape, or form at research needs or tribal agreements or anything like that. But what kind of off-ramp level, do we have some limitations on off-ramp levels as far as the number of fish, percentage of fish we're not going to mark? Because we'll get scrutinized on that if it's not handled correctly. I'd rather have it talked about now than later.
So, Chair Carpenter, thank you for the question. There are, depending on what you're trying to accomplish, we would look to our science teams to help develop what those adequate numbers are within the coded wire tag and mass marking system that's coastwide. So for instance, I was lucky enough to sit on the Elwha Dam removal team for the agency for a number of years, and there were a lot of years where we had a lot of coded wire tags out to try to give us some indications about survival and different parameters of the life history. But the northern fisheries don't always electronically sample unless they have coded wire or unless they have a mass mark, an external mass mark. And so it was then determined to start to mass mark a higher percentage of a conservation program so that we could tell where and at what levels those distant fisheries in Alaska, as well as the Canadian fisheries, were intercepting and harvesting conservation programs. And so that's usually a science-related question that can overlap into the Pacific Salmon Commission boundaries, as well as any coastwide programs. But typically, those decisions would be made at a co-manager level. There are some predetermined sizes depending on program, overall program size. I don't have those off the top of my head. I want to say it's about 150,000 coded wire tags per, like 1.5 million Chinook, for instance. But it can vary and does vary. There's also the comparative purpose of a double index tag group where you would mass mark and coded wire tag a group. You would just mass mark a group and then you would just coded wire tag a group so that you had a comparative difference between the survival of hatchery fish through a mark selective and normal harvest regimes, as well as those wild fish, those unmarked but coded wire tag fish, so that we can have a comparative difference of survival and interception rates on different stocks around Puget Sound and around Washington.
No, I appreciate the explanation. That's very helpful. I just want to make sure we're prepared to defend our approach to this. And I think you just did that, and I think we just need to be aware of it. Don, did I see your hand go up there a minute?
No questions for me.
Oh, okay. Any questions from anyone else? Okay. Ron, we're going to move into open public comment.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I didn't have a question. I do think maybe it might be useful before public testimony to share the Fish Committee recommendation.
Okay. All right.
And I can quickly read those four sentences. This is on the website for the public that's been following this. The Fish Committee met on Thursday, July 30th, via webinar to review the July 15th, 2020 draft policy language. The Fish Committee considered the policy level comments from a meeting with tribal co-managers on July 28th. Written public comment received in advance of the meeting and public testimony provided during the meeting. Based on the discussion at that time, the Fish Committee recommends the following policy language be adopted by the full commission as the public review draft released for this stage of the policy review process. Changes from the July 15th, 2020 draft are shown in red font and strikeout or yellow highlight. These changes are the result of considering the tribal co-manager consultation results. In addition to the policy language changes, the Fish Committee recommends that the detail that staff will provide, actually has just provided, for the two appendices would be included in the public review draft. And then what follows on the website is the policy language with those red font changes. I think almost all the commissioners were at that Fish Committee meeting, but I'd try to answer any questions if there happened to be any.
I don't see any questions. Okay, anyone else? All right, Nikki, would you do the intro into our public hearing?
Yes, sir. We will now take public comment from attendees. As a reminder, everyone receives 3 minutes for comment. Everyone is currently muted, so if you have a question, please raise your hand. Even if you pre-registered, still please raise your hand. If you're on the computer, the raise hand button appears under your name. If you're on the phone, please press *9 and wait to hear you have been unmuted.
Okay.
Let's see, so far we've got three.
Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Nikki. How many do we have?
So far we have three. We've got, and they're trickling in. So we'll just go ahead and roll into it. First one is Alan Chapman, followed by Bob Lake. Go ahead, Alan.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks again for the opportunity to provide comment. I support the modifications of the hatchery reform policy as proposed, and particularly the emphasis on agreed HGMPs, which acknowledge the risks, state-specific goals, provide adequate progress measures, and provisions for adaptive management. The original intent of hatchery reform was to change hatchery practices which did not have these specific measurable outcomes related to efficiently producing salmon, allowing sustainable fisheries as mitigated for lost habitat or restoration of natural populations. This was the original intent of the HSRG. Their recommendations were more concerning when they sought to address other salmon management issues. While there could be multiple objectives, there should be a commitment to measure performance related to risks and fully inform the concerned public of the results. I'm somewhat disappointed that the Nooksack region hatchery HGMPs are still in consultation status. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Chapman? Alan, thank you for your comments again. Have a good day. Next, Nikki. Yep.
Next, we've got Bob Lake, followed by Ann Presna. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, I think I'm unmuted.
Yep, you're good. Bob Lake.
I'm the president of the Wolf Bay Guild Association, also an advisor for both Grays Harbor and Willapaw Bay advisory groups. And I think, yeah, hatchery practices need to be liberalized and turned back, turn a wick up to turn around and start producing more fish. We have been totally decimated by lack of harvest in the Willapaw system. It's also had a big effect in Grays Harbor. And we know the Columbia River is absolutely in dire straits. So, yes, I think we need to up the production to maximize. And one thing I would like to bring out, when this HSRG was all presented and everything, Andy Appleby made the statement that if, in fact, we increase the production and everything, we're going to need some way to harvest these fish. And he said the only way possibly to do that is with gillnets. So if people want more fish, we're going to have to utilize the gillnets to manage the runs. And that needs to be recognized right from the onset. So we are all upfront about it, and the whole works. But we do need, in the state of Washington, common commercial fisheries for the public and also for the revenue. And it's a big thing in, like, Pacific County, Wakayakum counties. And I think that what you guys are doing. It's making good strides, and I hope we keep moving forward. And I know you've got quite a few other comments, and I know it's getting late, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much. And any questions?
Any questions of Bob? Hearing none, Bob, again, thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Next.
Okay, we got Ann Presna, followed by Conrad Gowell. Go ahead, Ann.
Hello, this is Ann Presna again for the counterpoint view. In addition to the background information I provided previously, I'm also on the board of the Coastal Watershed Institute, which restores nearshore habitat for wild fish. Overall, I oppose the increased reliance on hatchery fish and encourage a renewed focus on restoration of wild fish populations, which are rapidly declining. Their genetic diversity and adaptability is our best resource for dealing with the effects of climate change on fish populations. I encourage the Commission to restore the suspended provisions of the state's hatchery policy. I understand the Governor's Task Force on Southern Resident Killer Whales recommended increased hatchery production of Chinook as a way to feed orcas, and that suspension of key provisions in the hatchery management policy was done in part to allow for such increased production. My reading of the science tells me increased numbers of hatchery Chinook will likely lead to fewer numbers of wild Chinook that orcas feed on and produce much smaller hatchery fish that would not be a good food source for them. It is important to restore the suspended provisions to make sure wild fish are not threatened by the release of hatchery fish. I have sampled fish as part of Elwha River restoration efforts and observed hatchery fish that were much larger and far more numerous than the wild fish we were counting. I believe hatchery fish can pose a threat to wild fish by outcompeting them for limited food sources, introducing parasites or diseases, or diluting their genetics. Hatcheries can have a large negative effect on water quality, and I spent a part of my career enforcing water quality limits when hatcheries would violate them. As noted in my earlier comments, I encourage the Commission to follow the best currently available science on sustainable fishery management practices and keep the decision-making process open, transparent, and open-minded in deciding how to modify, if at all, the state's hatchery policy. Thank you very much.
Any questions from the Commission for Ann? Ann, thank you for your comments again.
You're welcome.
Nikki, next.
Okay, we've got Conrad Gowell, followed by Jack Stanford. Go ahead, Conrad.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Conrad Gowell, and I appreciate the ability to provide testimony today on this issue. Here we're talking about the artificial propagation of approximately 460 million fish in 2019 in Washington State through the Pacific Marine Fisheries Commission Regional Mark Information Center data. And that's up over 50 million fish since 2016. So the idea that we're cutting hatchery production in Washington State, looking at the data, doesn't appear to be true. And I think this flies in the face of your own science report. And that's also in consideration of your draft implementation report, which notes that 43 state hatchery programs are failing to meet broodstock standards. And 145 hatchery programs, half of them failed to meet monitoring and evaluation standards designed to protect wild fish populations. So we're already in a state where the risks are substantial. The science is ringing the bells of concern, and we're not heeding the policy that was designed to protect wild fish here. I wanted to start off with just a brief story about Chinook salmon. They're getting smaller, as many people know, over time. And they're showing up in their historic habitat, not able to turn over the gravel that they've historically laid their eggs in. And they're not able to mobilize that gravel into the future if we are just spawning them in hatcheries. We can restore that habitat that's been degraded, but if the fish aren't big enough to take advantage of it, that restoration will be spent, those dollars and investment will be done without the fish being able to reproduce there. I wanted to just also note that in many of the populations we're talking about, hatchery fish on the spawning grounds can make up almost 70% of the fish that are there. In the Fish Committee meeting on Thursday, there was some conversation around the 5% policy standards of the HSRG and whether or not a 6% or 4% difference was substantially different. And I just want to quote here really quickly from the HSRG white papers on that subject, that value of 6% for percentage of hatchery origin fish is vastly different than the 5% guideline and can pose a significant long-term genetic risk to the viability of naturally spawning populations. It should not be interpreted as benchmarks or goals, but rather this threshold should, exceeding this threshold should be a violation of those guidelines on a sustained basis and will pose long-term genetic risks to the future viability of naturally spawning fish. Lastly, I just want to end my comments noting the State Environmental Policy Act and Washington Administrative Procedures Act are in place to protect wild fish in issues like this. I am looking in to see whether or not this policy has undergone the necessary process. I've continued to note documents showing up on the website hours before public testimony, places where public testimony is not noted and is taken, and documents disappearing from the website over time. So I do believe there are significant adverse environmental impacts that are occurring and will continue to occur if this policy is going to be adopted. And with that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for Conrad? Seeing none, Conrad, thank you for your comments again. Have a good day. Nikki, next.
Next is Jack Stanford, followed by David Moskowitz. Go ahead, Jack. Make sure to unmute yourself. There you go.
Okay, I'm here.
All right.
Members of the commission, thanks for letting me make a couple of statements. My name is Jack Stanford. I'm a retired professor of ecology at the University of Montana. I had the good fortune of working for most of my career on salmon rivers around the Pacific Rim that don't have hatcheries, that are producing sustainable, huge populations of salmon and steelhead, all from wild populations. All of these sites are north of the Skeena and on around into Kamchatka. There's some hatchery production out there, but the two pertinent points that I wanted to remind you of, since I'm sort of new to the Washington scene, I recently moved to the Methow Valley. Two points I wanted to make that's based on many, many papers published in the last two or three decades is that, first of all, the 6 billion to 7 billion hatchery fish that we're pouring into the North Pacific have greatly increased the bycatch of wild fish. That's point number one. So point number two is that the size distribution of wild fish, Chinook, sockeye especially, in the North Pacific is declining at a very rapid rate, the size of the adult fish coming back. This means that they're less marketable, they're less fecund, their fitness is reduced, and so on. So at some point, hatchery programs overall have to be evaluated in the context of return on investment. And I would define return on investment in two ways. One is, how much does it cost to produce those 460 million fish they put out, or whatever the number is, and how many landed fish are a consequence of it, and what's the cost? The other return on investment is what has been the, external costs associated with the hatchery fish being produced in the context of also trying to save and recover and enhance wild populations. Those two things seem to me to be extremely counterproductive. So when I retired from my job, I sat down here on the Methow River, which has no dams on it. It's an unregulated river in pretty good shape. Some habitat problems probably, but a huge investment here, three hatcheries. I think they're growing steelhead and Chinook, but no fishing season, and the return is way, way less than 0.1%. So here's where my urging you to take a look at the overarching costs versus the return on it, and ask yourself, what would happen if we didn't produce fish in a river like the Mattow from hatcheries and let the wild fish have a go at it for a decade or so on their own? Where that's been tried around the world, and particularly in the Northwest, it's been very successful. The return has been something around 5 to 10% of wild fish coming back as landed adults.
Hey, Jack, you're at time.
Yeah, so that's my point, and thanks for allowing me to say a couple of words. I'm new to the area and interested in what's going on.
Any questions for Jack? Jack, thank you very much for your comments. Nikki, next.
Next, we've got David Moskowitz, followed by Greg King, and then Jamie Glasgow.
Okay.
Go ahead, David.
Thank you very much. Chair Carpenter, members of the commission, thank you for your service and working on a Saturday. It certainly increases public participation on these important issues. My day started making coffee and seeing a hummingbird hovering outside my window. 50 wing beats per second, a true miracle of nature. Sadly, the public process benefits and expertise that the commission that you're showing has not been part of the process in reviewing policy 3619. Starting from the very first action in June 2018, which was meant to be a briefing and possible guidance, but actually a decision was made to suspend three HSRG criteria without adequate public notice. The subsequent process abnormalities continued and even were evident on the July 30th with an agenda that did not describe an opportunity to comment and a draft policy with changes that were delivered that day. These process problems on the hatchery reform policy stand in stark contrast to the department and commission's efforts on so many other issues. The commission could offer a small fix for these problems by doing two things. One, you should ask the department to schedule a workshop with wild fish scientists and policy experts, with WDFW staff, and with participation of up to four commissioners, just as was provided to the tribal co-managers. The process has not provided this opportunity for constructive discussion between managers and groups such as salmon recovery boards, nonprofit organizations, and independent scientific experts. That is one thing that could happen. And let's take a step back and look at a broader view. The region has been emphasizing hatchery production since 1877. And what is the track record? If hatcheries worked, the region would be awash in hatchery fish. Before just tinkering with this policy, Washington should review its existing programs on an economic and ecologic basis. That would be a good first step. WDFW's own review of more scientific literature, the most recent, was conducted to discover benefits of hatcheries, and they found, quote, few examples and sparse evidence. That statement needs to resonate for quite a while. Wild steelhead salmon hold the key to the future in Washington everywhere they exist. The genetic and life history diversity found in wild salmon steelhead born in their natal rivers are the legacy resource the commission must protect. You can't buy it. You can't make it. These gifts from nature may be decipherable scientifically, but they are not understood. And that's what is risk every time management prioritizes hatchery production. And this policy minimizes the risk of hatcheries. It does not address uncertainty and assumes that conservation and mitigation hatcheries actually work. Much of this policy assumes that management can control hatchery fish impacts on wild fish. But once the fish leave the hatchery, once they are released beyond the hatchery fence, management cannot control or effectively manage hatchery fish impacts on wild fish. There are so many unknowns about wild fish genetics, life history, behaviors, and characteristics, and they are all at risk by using hatchery production. And once these are lost, they are gone forever.
Hey, David, your time.
Okay, I will wrap up. Think about ducks and wolves, both hunted near extinction. Ducks were recovered with the end of market hunting and wetland protection. Wolves were recovered by changing hunting and predator controls. Hatchery production of wild animals does not work. It's a diminishing return over time, and they're released into an ocean pasture that is overgrazed already. It is delusional to think we can release more fish and expect returns. They're either not going to return or they're going to be very small, as many people said. Keep in mind the hummingbird, a miracle of nature, just like Washington's wild steelhead and salmon. Thank you so much for working on hard the past 3 days and taking the comments. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Any questions for David? Hearing none, David, again, thank you for your comments. Have a good day.
Next we've got Greg King, followed by Jamie Glasgow. Go ahead, Greg.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Good afternoon, Chair Carpenter, Commission, Director Suswin, staff. 120 years of hatcheries, 405 billion eggs transferred from basin to basin. But do we truly have a wild fish? I highly doubt it. President Puget Sound Anglers, Lower Columbia River Chapter, I believe that we should ingest these words into the policy for approval by the commission. I'd like to also state we have to look at some of our hatchery practices in the Snake River Conservation Hatchery, Johnson Creek, 27 fall Chinook recovered. Now we're actually fishing on that, those fall Chinook. Callets, coho. We're looking at pretty robust runs on the callets. You know, some years are good, some years are bad, but everything on the callets is because of hatchery fish. And if you read any studies in the Pacific Northwest on hatchery fish, on wild fish studies, excuse me, it shows that hatchery fish are a tool to recovery of wild species in the Pacific Northwest. And I sent you guys an email with the natural origin. It's from the American Fishery Society. It's Ian Quarters wrote it. It's the newest thing out. It was first published in December 2018. It's natural origin steelhead populations on Clackamas River study that shows that summer run steelhead had no effect on late winter wild steelhead in the Clackamas River. And this is some new science that comes out that shows us that these some of this other science was kind of faulty. You know, thanks for your time, HSRG. You've been great, you know, but just not working. It's just not working. We have to use our hatchery fish to recover wild fish. And that's how we're going to do it. That's what's being said. That's what's being done. The Yakima tribe is doing a lot of research on hatchery fish and their resurgent in the Yakima River. They're doing coho studies, they're doing kilting studies, they're doing spring Chinook studies. They're doing wonderful work, and it's all with hatchery fish. And Larry, I just want to comment. I think I heard that was a marking rate of 2% in federal hatcheries. I could be wrong. I think it's 2% you can mark your fish at. But anyway, let's keep hatcheries going, and let's use them as a recovery tool. Thanks for your time. That's my comments.
Any questions of Greg from the commission? Hearing none, Greg, thank you. Have a good day. Appreciate it. Next, please, Nikki.
Jamie Glasgow, followed by Ron Garner. Go ahead, Jamie.
Yes, hi, Chair Carpenter. My name is Jamie Glasgow, Director of Science for Wild Fish Conservancy. Thanks for the opportunity. I hope you all have had a chance to read the comments we submitted earlier this week, including concerns raised by former Washington Fish and Wildlife Commissioners and 75 independent scientists and advocates. If not, know that they're in your inbox, and I hope you'll have a chance to get to them. I, along with others, are very concerned that you're underestimating the significance of this policy. We're at a fork in the road to recovery. To the left is a path where we actually implement the original 3619 policy and stay true to the best available science. The implementation assessment you commissioned has demonstrated that hasn't happened yet. On this path, we recover locally adapted wild salmon that are resilient to climate change while managing appropriately scaled hatchery programs and marked selective fisheries. We have wild fish with a genetic fortitude to thrive as habitat and ocean conditions continue to improve. On the path to the right, we ignore some of the inconvenient science and increase hatchery production in excess of HSRG thresholds. This is the path that the 3619 review and rewrite points us towards. Here, we increase genetic, ecological, and fishery impacts on wild fish populations and undermine the millions of dollars spent each year on wild fish habitat restoration efforts. On this path, we choose a future where each year we hope the state's budget is sufficient to raise our salmon in buildings. On this path, we steal opportunity from future generations who won't even know what we took from them. Ron mentioned the draft policy's reliance on HGMPs to effectively manage hatchery program impacts on wild fish. If this is the direction we're going, I suggest the commission request an implementation assessment from the WDFW Science Division, similar to the 3619 implementation assessment just performed, to determine how well the department has been achieving the required benchmarks in existing HGMPs. I believe the conclusions will be similar. We are adept at making commitments to science-based management on paper, but not at delivering results. As I've mentioned before to you all, I feel this policy revision process has been opaque to the public. The draft we are discussing today was provided to the public on Wednesday, the 29th, just 3 days ago, despite being dated July 15th. The previous draft was released to the public in a very similar way. Given the significance of what's at stake, we need more time to review and provide comments. Also, considering the environmental implications of this new policy, we are concerned that it has not gone through SEPA review. We're currently exploring this deficiency and will be in touch with questions. For these reasons, we request that you suspend further development of the 3619 policy changes and reaffirm the state's commitment to science-based hatchery management by reinstating guidelines 1, 2, and 3 that were suspended in 2018. We'd welcome the opportunity to continue this conversation later in the month, and I do appreciate your thought and consideration that you're putting into this. Thank you.
Any questions from the commission for Jamie? Jamie, thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. Next, right. Nikki.
Next, we got Ron Gardner, followed by Larry Pryor. Go ahead, Ron.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. Thank you, commissioners, director, everybody today for the opportunity to speak on this. As you know, I'm the president of the Puget Sound Anglers State Board and also one of the Orca Task Force members that we did an incredible amount of work, 52 of us, trying to rebuild orca populations through salmon. And there's a misconception out there that if we just quit hatcheries, that wild fish will magically rebound. Since 1992, we have cut back hatchery production on Chinook and Coho over 160 million fish annually. Where's these wild fish that should have popped back up in these areas? We don't have the habitat of the 1800s any longer. It just seems to be that we're going to wave this magic wand and these big fish are going to come back. We have not stopped losing habitat. If you want to look at habitat where it was rebuilt to pristine conditions, look at the Cedar River. The Chinook never came screaming back there. It barely even moved the needle. They spent, I can't remember how much, they completely redid that whole system down there. Wild fish would come back, and they didn't. It didn't happen. We do not have what we used to. Before we started working on this new policy, the HSRG, which was suspended, the Hatchery Science Review Group, what these issues are in there was there was never a scientific paper, white paper, made as a basis for HSRG for this. It was strictly an opinion. It was an experiment, and it was thought to fix it. And what's happened since then in ESA, we have 43% less wild fish. So while we're beating our heads against the wall, you got to take reality into consideration. We have we've lost so much habitat. We have 85% less quality estuary habitat on the West Coast California is putting out way more fish than we are, with way less quality habitat and water. And that's per a NOAA study that's shown up. I'm reading a couple things here. What's really changed? Why aren't we having these big runs back? Before ESA, when a river crashed, we took eggs and we repopulated it from an out-of-basin system. That was the normal for over 100 years. Then all of a sudden, we go to ESA where we can't cross fish into other rivers. We stop that. When that river crashes, we don't put the fish back in there to rebuild it anymore. That's a major missed consideration that people are not looking at. If you can't prop up these runs, they don't come back. If you lose them, today's days, we've got 60-year floods, Cameron, every few years that are washing out the egg beds. I know there was talk about the fish not being big enough to get down into the bigger rocks, which is true, but we don't have the habitat that we used to support these big fish.
We're at time.
Okay, I just want to say thank you, and Puget Sound Anglers supports these changes, and we appreciate everybody's hard work. Thank you.
Any questions of Ron? Ron, thank you for your comments. Next, Nikki.
Next is Larry Pryor, followed by Lisa Olson, and then our last person is Nathan Grimm. Go ahead, Larry.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity. My name is Larry Pryor. I'm the chairman of Northwest Fisheries Enhancement. We can get into that a little bit later here. We're a relatively new group, but we are out looking and contracting for hatchery management services, which, listening to some of your discussion yesterday about budget cutbacks, you know, have you entertained the thought of contracting out to private service? We're not-for-profit or other, but we look, encouraging new and non-traditional partnerships. But that's not what my discussion is here about today. And, and you've obviously done a lot of work on the hatchery, what was previously hatchery reform, now hatchery policy. And I get to a number of different groups and meetings, of which you do too, obviously. In previous, in a lot of discussions, I don't know how many times I've heard about PNOS and PHAS and a number of those different things from the HSRG. One of the things I noticed in your policy here is that it is in a good movement here. It is to improve hatchery effectiveness. One of my biggest complaints, and I'm involved in down in the Calix, the Crag meeting, and we recently finished an assessment with recommendations down in the Lewis River here, and a number of other things. One of the biggest things that I see and hear is, and I also the Northwest Power Council, is that there's not a gauge for what is hatchery effectiveness, as policymakers, one of the things I see missing here, and we're talking about hatchery efficiencies, is what is a gauge for improving hatchery efficiencies? As you hear a lot of discussions about PHAS and PNOS, of those sort of things, you hardly ever hear about how well is a hatchery, how effective is a hatchery, until, the runs fall off. HSRG in their 2009 report talk about that, and one of their primary is maximize survival of hatchery fish, and that the gauge should be an adult return goals, adult produce rather than those, primary performance measurement for hatchery program should be the total number of adults produced, those caught in fisheries plus those that escaped to that natural per adult spawn at the hatchery. All too often, the past hatcheries have instead been evaluated based on the number of small trillies, which is like evaluating a farm based on the pounds of seed planted rather than the size and quality of the property. There isn't much in the way of what is an efficient hatchery until the fish runs fall off. The Northwest Power Council has addressed this here for long term. They've set 2 to 6% of goals. They call them objectives here, and they manage and monitor that. And that's for their naturals and for their hatcheries and where they're at. You know, in the Northwest, in particular Washington, I don't know of any of those, and it certainly is not any real. You know, what is the goal of efficient hatcheries? There just doesn't seem to be any.
Larry, you're at time.
Okay. Well, I could go on for days about this and how to discuss about what's efficient hatchery or how to make those improvements. But thanks.
Larry, one of the commissioners has a question perhaps for you, and please feel free to send in any comments to Nikki and to the commission if you'd like. Mr. Thorburn.
Hey.
Thank you, Larry. I was curious from your comments whether you have a position on the proposed revisions, whether you're for or against. You know, we looked at the performance of the previous policy, and I think actually identified some of the issues that you raised, that we need to be very clear about the goals of our various hatcheries, that some are for conservation purposes solely, some are for production for recreation, and then had a lot of discussion about the need for monitoring. I was just curious, in light of your comments, what your position is on the proposed changes.
Well, again, I don't think that you've developed a gauge here for what the goals are, but certainly a lot. I guess my suggestion is that you, and the same with what the HSRG says, is that you develop, and one of our major recommendations that we made here is what hatcheries, and I get into a number of different hatcheries. You can go in and ask them, and I have some primary questions. One is, what are your SARs? What are your long-term goals? When I get into tribal hatcheries, I tell you that we have some good conversation about that. When I get into state, even U.S. Fish and Wildlife hatcheries, there's not. Matter of fact, the answers I'll get is, well, we produce 1.7 million fish. Those SARs are in the desk here someplace. And in that, you know, my suggestion, I guess, is to include adult return goals and a shift from a production mentality to an adult return goals mentality. Once you can make a shift towards adult return goals mentality, many things will fall. The other additional thing that I didn't include, when I talk to a lot of fishermen, get out in the communities, the other thing is accountability. In hatchery management, when you get out and talk to sportsmen, the word that comes up a lot is accountability, or there's no accountability in that. So the point is that what I would suggest for you as policymakers is that you set some goal range for hatchery efficiencies or success, whatever, a lot like the Northwest Power Council has, at 2 to 6% of historical. Then you have some accountability for that. It's a measure of accountability for that, because there isn't any. You know, and I could sit here and go on and on about different hatcheries, SARs, and a lot of different stuff at work, but that's what in your hatchery policy. And that once you set those goals, you know, that the word out, you know, when you talk to a lot of fishermen, you know, you always hear, we got to increase production. You always got to hear, we got to increase production. You hardly ever hear, well, what can we do to increase the efficiency of the adult return goals here for the number of fish that we're producing? And that once we increase our efficiencies here, maybe we can reduce our to meet production amounts to meet those same adult return goals. And so that within the policy, I think, it, you know, you're not setting, you know, what the those goals or, you know, shift to adult return goals and the measurement of that and the accountability for that. So I could go on for a day.
Larry, thank you for your comments, and look forward to hearing more in the future.
Thanks.
You bet. Next, Nikki.
Okay, we've got Lisa Olson, followed by Nathan Grimm. Go ahead, Lisa. Make sure to unmute.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I was with you guys yesterday too, but I was a little ignorant on having to raise my hand. So lucky for you, you didn't get to hear me yesterday, but I'm going to indulge you a little bit because I usually don't take up all my time. I'd like to just make a quick comment on the Columbia River policy. I would very much favor the changes that you're headed toward. I think it's really great. I love the cooperation that it seems to be between the commercials, the sports, the DFW, the commission, and the tribes. Thank you to those of you on the Fish Committee. I think you've worked really hard at that. On the buyback, I'd just like to say that I think that the only reason there's even being a buyback considered and that there's so many inactive licenses out there is because there are no fish. There haven't been fish for a long time. So there's nothing wrong with making a living in the renewable resources in this area, and I hope that we are able to work together to maintain them so that people can still do that. On the hatcheries, I'm happy about the direction this is going. The hatcheries have been around for a good long time when there were some really solid salmon runs. I think we can get back to more of that area again. Probably as Mr. Garner said, we're never going to get back to where we used to be just because there's so many people in the state now, and there's so many, I think a lot of the habitat is the issue. I, for one, would like to see people have to have a passport to be able to move here, but you know, that's just my opinion. I think that, you know, if you want to work at Habitat, you better start going to your planning commission meetings, folks, because that's part of our problem. The Willapa is a unique situation, in my uneducated opinion, that we should be putting more and more fish out of these hatcheries to help with lots of different existences, the orcas, and, you know, not to mention the commercial fishermen. They're not bad people. They're conservationists, just like farmers and fishermen are conservationists, no matter what stripe they come from. So that's it. Thank you. Thank you for all your hard work. Thank you for being here on a Saturday, and thank you for listening to me.
One moment, Lisa. Commissioner McIsaac has a question for you, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very quickly, thank you for your testimony. And are you here today testifying on behalf of yourself, or are you bringing a perspective representing others?
Oh, I apologize. I forgot to say I was a Pacific County Commissioner, and kind of both, you know, on the economics of the county. I feel that the commercial fisherman is an endangered species, so I'm always here advocating for them. And, you know, but also for the people that like to sport fish. I think there's a good balance to be had, and I think we can get there. We just have to kind of quit pointing fingers and work together, and I think we're heading in the right direction. My apologies, Commissioner McIsaac. I didn't really verify who I was.
No apologies necessary. Thank you for taking
me to here. Thank you for your comments, Lisa. Have a nice day.
You too.
Nikki, next.
Next, we've got Nathan Grimm, followed by Rich Sims. Go ahead, Nathan.
Good afternoon again, commissioners and staff. Nathan Grimm, Pasco, Washington, Columbia River Recreational Advisor, Master Hunter. Again, I will thank you guys as support staff for putting together these webinars and the work that they do behind the scenes to pull this off and allow us all to get together. I really appreciate it as a citizen. I heard some things that disturb me, that I question about size of fish and fitness. And it's easy to blame, I guess, hatcheries, but I don't know that we've done any studying to see if it's hatcheries or other things. If you imagine a gill net like a window screen. It's going to keep out the big bugs, but it lets the little ones through. So if all we're returning to spawn are fish that make it through gillnet fisheries, and that's treaty fisheries and non-treaty fisheries, I think you're going to that has a possibility of affecting size. I haven't studied it, but common sense, I think, tells us that. So let's not blame hatcheries for the size or fitness of a fish. I do think that it's possible to have sustainable hatchery programs and wild populations. The Hanford Reach is a perfect example of such. It's the cornerstone upriver bright fall Chinook population, and it's the largest natural spawning population of Chinook in the lower 48, with a lot of hatchery production in essentially the same area. And there hasn't been a negative or detrimental effect on that population. I do agree with the previous speaker, Larry, on establishing adult return goals versus smolt production goals. And I think that's something to focus on, because it just saying, oh, well, we put out 100,000 fish, you know, there's a reason for that hatchery. It's a mitigation or supplement, or there's a reason for the program. And if it's meant to mitigate and replace so many adult fish, then the goal should not be producing 100,000 smolts. The goal should be producing and releasing the smolts it takes to reduce or to replace the adult population.
Nathan, you have time.
I think to go along with that adult return goal, you would also have to add smolt to adult ratios. But policy without performance metrics leads to controversy and then finger pointing, and everyone says it's everyone else's fault. So I would encourage adding performance metrics to the policy. Thank you.
Again, thank you for your comments again, Nathan. We have two more on this agenda item.
Yep, we've got Rich Sims. Go ahead, Richard. Make sure to unmute yourself.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Okay, thanks. Good afternoon, and thank you, commissioners and Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife staff, for the opportunity to comment today. I hope everyone's doing well in this pandemic. I know it's been a challenge for many of us. My name's Rich Sims, a lifelong Washington angler and founding board member for the Wild Steelhead Coalition, dedicated to increasing the return of wild steelhead to the waters of the Pacific Northwest. The Wild Steelhead Coalition was a member of the HSRG advisory group with the focus to support the best science available to manage hatcheries in Washington State and their effects on wild fish, which are at a dismal fraction of their historic abundance. We are opposed to the proposed changes or any efforts to weaken or reduce the HRG recommendations. We do support refinements with incorporation of the best science as it becomes available. Wild steelhead and salmon are extreme risk or being lost forever. At this point, they deserve practice of the best science available for their recovery. Let's not be the generation who simply lets them slip away because of our focus on the short rather than the long term of wild fish for all our citizens. So thanks again today. I appreciate your time for your allowing comments.
Any questions for Rich today? Rich, thank you very much for your comments. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Next, Nikki. Oh, pardon me. Commissioner McIsaac has his hand up.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I thought that was the last of the public testimony. So I'll wait till after public testimony.
We have one more. This is it right now.
Lee Blankenship, go ahead. Did you want to make comment?
Hi, Commissioner Carpenter and fellow commissioners. I appreciate the opportunity to provide comments on the hatch reform policy today. I'm retired from WEFW after 30 years of, as a senior research scientist, and I served both as a member representing the department on the HSRG and then after retirement from the agency as an independent scientist on the HSRG. Unfortunately, due to COVID or whatever, I didn't see the new revision until today when Ron presented it. So I'll change my what I have to say and go freehand. But essentially, I'm concerned. It says a lot of the right things, but there's no meat to it. There's no real science behind it as I see it. For instance, and I think it was the guideline 7, it talked about trying to preserve those areas that those fish stocks that hadn't had significant introgression from hatchery fish and exempted those that had. 90% of our natural fish have significant introgression, and that's what a lot of the science is about. It's about giving those wild fish a chance for local adaptation. They're very plastic fish, and if you, given the habitat they have, whether it's good or bad or degraded, they can adjust to that, and we need that local adaptation so much more now because of the effects of climate change. If we don't give wild fish a chance to locally adapt, they're just not going to make it. And they can't locally adapt when you have such a high infusion of hatchery fish mating with them or together in the stream. From the comments by Ron, I can see that the agency's really put a lot of weight on saying we have ESA and HGMPs. It's a legal determination of status and protection. So why should we follow the, I guess the question then, why should we follow the science beyond ESA requirements? Well, in my mind, ESA sets a pretty low bar. It's designed to prevent extinction and is not nearly as concerned about maintaining sustainable fisheries, which is also the department's mandate and was the mandate of the HSRG. Both those by the Congress, the HSRG was to help conserve naturally spotted stocks and to support sustainable fisheries, just as the RCW for the commission and the agency is to conserve the wildlife, food fish, game fish, and shellfish resources in a manner that does not impair the resource.
Hey, Lee, you're at time.
Excuse me?
You're at time.
Go ahead and wrap your thoughts up, Lee.
Huh?
Go ahead and wrap your thoughts up if you'd like.
Wow, that was quick. Okay. I'll just say that the HSRG didn't make up the science. The recommendations were based on continual reviews of hundreds of reviewed papers and studies. When the current policy was started, there was new science that might be counter to the policy. Both your reviews for the outside view said that wasn't the case. I hope you see that there's a moral and legal responsibility in the state's guiding legislation for WDFW to preserve, protect, and perpetuate, rather than impair and jeopardize the resource for future generations. By not implementing the science and removing them from the new policy, you're seriously jeopardizing the future of the resource. Thanks for your time.
Lee, hold on a minute. Commissioner Thorburn has a question or comment. Commissioner Thorburn?
Thank you, Lee. I heard your comment about the ESA saying that it's designed to prevent extinction. My sort of broad understanding of the ESA is that it is designed both to prevent extinction and aid recovery. It's been most successful at preventing extinction because, of course, the recovery part is much more challenging. It just seems to me when we look at listed species for whom we're going to allow harvest take, that the bar that we're looking at is not so much contributing to the recovery part, but just ensuring that if we're going to allow a legal take through harvest, it's preventing extinction. I think those are, that's a distinction that I would like to emphasize as we review all of our policies that involve listed species, particularly these fish policies that we're looking at.
I would agree, Commissioner Thornburg. The science says when you're trying to avoid extinction, you allow hatchery fish to rebuild the program. But after you've got a base, then the science kicks in that you don't want, you want those fish to locally adapt and flourish. And more hatchery fish on them at that point only reduces their fitness and their survival. And they can never get to that next level because of the infusion of bad genes and reduced fitness from hatchery fish. You're exactly right.
Any other questions for Lee? Lee, thank you so much for your comments today. Take care, please. Okay. Nikki, that is it. Oh, excuse me, Commissioner McIsaac, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The public testimony has been very valuable. I think it's appropriate to make a decision on the release of a public review draft, and I'm prepared to make a motion to that regard if that suits you.
Well, that was my thought earlier, and it may still be that. I'm somewhat concerned about some potential threats that I heard on the comments today. Not that we're going to make our decisions based on other people's potential threats, but there's some issues out there I'm afraid we're going to have to deal with. But I guess the one way to get it started for sure is to get the draft out and let people critique it and provide comments.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Then let me go ahead and try a motion here, and I'm going to try to put it in writing here and share this screen. It's very short, and if it's seconded, I'd like to speak to it. So I would move that the draft language contained in the Fish Committee recommendation, together with the detailed appendices presented by staff, be released for public review. Written comment and public testimony is to be considered by the Commission at September 10 to 12, 2020 meeting.
So we have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Commissioner Thorburn is a second. Any further, you would like to speak to the motion, Don? Go ahead.
Yeah, just quickly. This motion would carry with it the ability for staff to clean up any typos that are in there. I think I spotted one and changed the font color, of course. At the Fish Committee, we talked about maybe another language change that got to the risk assessment for any significant hatchery changes, but I've not included that in this motion. I would like to rely on some thorough public testimony over the course of the next month and a half or so to try to hear more about that particular one, but also some of the other matters that we heard in public testimony. I think there's a general fear from some of the folks that is not founded, and I would particularly like them to take a look at this language and submit some comments test their thinking about what they see here. We had some comment about not addressing uncertainty. We had some comment that alluded to ignoring the science or not following the science. And so I would really like to hear from the public where in that language they feel like that is contained. I know that a couple folks spoke about the fact that they hadn't seen this in advance, and back through the process, they might not have been following the process quite so closely with regard to the committee business. But that this language is there now. And so, for example, Mr. Blankenship, who I'd commend for his past experience on all this and his participation on the HSRG, mentioned in guideline number 7 something about exempting genetic populations that have some salmon populations that have some genetic introgression. And I don't believe the language says that, but if people read it that way, I would sure be interested in hearing about that, for example. So I would like to see some robust review by the public, and then we can consider all of that and maybe some of your other concerns between now and September 10th and 12th, and maybe at that time as well.
Any additional comments from any of the commissioners? Okay, hearing none, I'll call for the question. All those in favor of Commissioner McIsaac's motion say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Ron, thank you very much for taking your seat.